Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Got a question for you this week. Whatever happened to the Equal Rights Amendment? Think about that a moment. The ERA. Yeah, I kind of vaguely remember something about equal rights and the Constitution. Don't we already have an equal protection clause? And isn't that the same thing? Or it's ringing some bells here. Wasn't a bunch of angry women, you know, marching around? This is sort of a 70s thing? Yeah, sort of, kind of. I recently was wondering that myself. Whatever happened to that Equal Rights Amendment? And fortunately, I happen to know somebody who knows all about this. If you were listening last summer, you already know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about, of course, Wanda Sobieski, an attorney in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I spend my summers. And I spoke to Wanda last year about the women's suffrage movement. This year, we talked about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, I guess really my interest in it probably started, at least in the philosophy of it, began when I was really a young child. I never really quite understood why we treat some people one way and other people another way. Mm-hmm. I always thought we should all play by the same rules. And I suppose that same notion that eventually led me to law school also influenced my interest in the Equal Rights Amendment. It just seemed so common sense. How could anyone who was proud of a country that was established on individual freedom and rights and opportunity be opposed to making sure that all of the population had the same opportunities? So it seemed to me to be a no-brainer. And when I saw opposition springing up to it, I was shocked.
I see. In fact, if I recall correctly, you said it sort of reminded you of the battle over women's suffrage earlier in the century.
Well, actually, I first learned about the suffrage battle while working on the Equal Rights Amendment. When I was with some groups and we were analyzing the opposition and the kinds of arguments that were being made, and more shockingly, the kinds of arguments that people were buying into, one of the women mentioned to me that it was nothing new. They were saying the same things they said against women's right to vote. And I just couldn't fathom women's right to vote being controversial. So I went out to research it on my own.
And it was pretty controversial, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a firestorm, much like we experienced with the Equal Rights Amendment.
Okay, well, this is a good time to say, what was this Equal Rights Amendment? A lot of people may not even have heard of it now. What was it?
It was a simple, basically 24 words of the core of the amendment, which is that equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
And it was
That was it.
Those were the words.
Those were the words. I mean, please
read them again.
Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
Well, I'm going to have to agree with you as a preliminary matter. Where's the controversy in that one? Maybe I'm too much a product of my time, but I mean, that seems self-evident too, doesn't it?
Well, actually, most people were opposed to the amendment, thought it was some huge, crazy, convoluted thing, in large part because of the propaganda that came from the people opposed to the amendment. It was astounding, the opposition it drew. It actually had its roots in the suffrage movement. Alice Paul, who was the young militant suffragist that led the women to demonstrate outside the White House gates and burn the words of President Wilson when he talked about the glories of democracy abroad and denied it to the women at home.
But this is radio, so people can't see you smiling as you describe her burning the president's words. Anyway,
well,
go on.
There was some real irony to what he was telling Europe and the rest of the world about making the world safe for democracy, and at the same time not giving democracy to half his own population. Mm-hmm. So they called him out on that inconsistency. And that stirred up a lot of interest and actually probably was important to the ultimate passage of the women's right to vote. But Alice Paul knew that the right to vote was really just the beginning. It wasn't the end. It didn't ensure that women would be treated as equals and have all the same opportunities as other people in the country had. And so in 1923, she proposed what was known as a Lucretia Mott Amendment, which was slightly different in the words that it used in describing the amendment. It just said that men and women, let me see if I can get the words exactly right here, men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction. That was the original Equal Rights Amendment. It was introduced in Congress in 1923, 3 years after the passage of suffrage, and then introduced every year thereafter until 1972.
Oh, this is, now you're teaching me something I didn't know here. I always think of the ERA as having been a 1960s and 70s phenomenon, but you're telling me this the proposals go back to the 1920s.
Absolutely. And it was reintroduced year after year after year after year. 49 years it took to get the amendment out of Congress. Now, you may recall that from the suffrage story, it took 72 years from the date of the first public call for suffrage at Seneca Falls in 1848 until Tennessee made the amendment a reality in 1920. So 49 years in Congress before Congress finally sent it out to the states.
Well, you shaved off about 20 years as compared with suffrage then.
Oh, that's just getting it out to the states. It's not getting it ratified.
Let's talk about the amendment process just briefly. Article 5 of the Constitution provides a couple of different ways of amending it, but one of them, and the one that I think we're talking about here in both cases, is that Congress, two-thirds of Congress, approves or proposes an amendment to the states.
Exactly.
Then that's sent out for ratification, and in order to become part of the Constitution, three-quarters of the states have to ratify.
Exactly.
And the, depending on the particular wording of the amendment, there might be a time limit imposed as well. Okay, then that's going to be a big issue coming up. Okay, I just wanted to mention that right now as potentially part of the process.
Well, the Constitution doesn't expressly authorize a time limit.
Right, it doesn't. It's not part of Article 5, okay? And in fact, one, you mentioned that there at least has been one amendment that was proposed by James Madison.
Why, yes, there is. One of the problems the Equal Rights Amendment ran into was that it was tagged with a 7-year time limit.
Right.
And although a 3-year extension was eventually granted by Congress to that time period, still within the existing time period, they were unable to get enough states to ratify. We needed 38 states, 38 out of 50, to reach the 75%. One of the problems that, I guess the way to look at it now is there is this group of people who are introducing what they call the three-state strategy, because only three more states are needed to ratify.
Well, before we get to that one, let me just, we've got, and let's, if you don't mind, let's clarify what the Madison Amendment was.
Okay.
Madison, when he originally proposed his Bill of Rights, he proposed 16, Congress passed 12, and of course only 10 were included in the Bill of Rights. So there were two more hanging out there. And one of those two, what eventually became the 27th Amendment, wasn't ratified for 200 and couple of years.
203 years. 200,
okay, 1992. Okay. So we've got precedent out there that pursuant to the Article 5 procedure, you can take as long as you want to, basically, and still ratify this amendment. And as you point out, that's all Article 5 says. It doesn't say anything about time limits. So that's sort of generally out there. That's the accepted procedure. That's what's going on here. But in this 50-year, almost 50-year process of reintroducing and reintroducing and reintroducing the Equal Rights Amendment for women, Congress eventually passes it in what year did you say? 1972, but it does so with a 7-year time limit.
The 7-year time limit in the preamble.
Okay, it's put in the preamble to the legislation proposing it.
Right.
So that's an additional requirement, which is of debatable constitutionality.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And that creates a practical problem for the proponents of the ERA throughout the 1970s. Okay.
Absolutely.
Is that all correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now,
please tell me what happened from 1972 forward.
Well, from 1973, from the time it came out in March of 1972 to the end of 1973, some 30 states ratified the amendment. So we were well along the way. In 1974, three more states ratified, one in 75, and then none in 76, one in 77, and that's where it stalled, at 35 states.
Wow, so that's what you were talking about with the three-state strategy.
Right. The three-state strategy is to say that the time limitation is unconstitutional and ineffective, and that this amendment, if we get three more states, will become reality with the vote of three states, just like the 27th Amendment became reality 203 years later when it became fully ratified. So that's a three-state strategy that some people are working on now. It has a couple of unanswered legal questions.
Okay, even to this day, there are people out there who are trying to get three more states to ratify.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. What happened during the 1970s? And you had this big rush of states in the first year or two, then it kind of slowed to a trickle. Then it stalled in about 76 or so, and I think that's about the time I recall becoming aware of it, because the clock was ticking, and the proponents were running into a wall. Please describe who were the proponents, who were the opponents, what were the arguments that were being made?
Well, the proponents were really largely young women who carried at least the leadership roles in the Equal Rights Amendment. They were women who wanted to be professionals and go to professional schools and wanted to be able to have access, full access to education and careers, wanted to have careers and families, and so they came with great hopes. I personally entered it about the time that my daughter, which would be 1974, was born. A little before that I was involved, but I honestly believed in my heart that by the time she turned 18, she would have full constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's not anything in public life has disappointed me as much as to know that I now have a granddaughter, born to that daughter, who may not have full constitutional rights when she reaches 18.
Mm. So this was not just women, it was parents of daughters especially, I imagine,
yes,
who formed part of the, whether they were fathers or mothers of their daughters, who might have gotten very motivated in that regard.
And while I don't know if it's scientific, at least in my anecdotal experience, the older men seemed to be more supportive than were contemporary younger men.
Really?
I think older men looking at their daughters wanting equal opportunity for them was a big factor. Younger men looked at women as competition for jobs, as not quite sure what their role would be in marriage or whether they would even refuse to get married. I mean, that's where a lot of the arguments that were used against suffrage came back and reared their ugly heads again in the Equal Rights Amendment campaign.
Right. Sorry about my cell phone there.
That's okay.
But to get back to that then, parenthood changes us all. In some respects, it's one of the most remarkable experiences anyone can have, and I say that as a father myself. But it's not something that's necessarily predictable, how it's going to do it. But what I'm hearing from you is you're saying that when people would have daughters, they might all of a sudden start getting very interested in what was going on with them and with their futures.
It seemed to make a lot of difference in their viewpoint. Mm-hmm. They could suddenly, some men who never would have understood younger in their lives, the importance of equal opportunity, really understood it when it came to their daughters.
Hmm. All right, now what were some of the specific arguments that the people who were opposed were making?
Well, they came from a lot of different directions. One of the biggest problems, unfortunately, came from certain religions, because they believed that women had very specific and limited roles, and I guess there was concern that if they had economic equality and opportunity, that somehow they wouldn't fulfill those roles. And that then some things became really distorted. There were the kinds of things that they said against suffragists, that women would refuse to marry, that it would be the end of the human race because women would refuse to have children if they had the opportunity to go out and work instead.
Hmm.
That there was a lot of social arguments, social unrest kinds of arguments. There was a lot of race-mongering.
Race-mongering? Now tell me about that.
Well, basically that giving equal rights to women would give more power to black women. And the same argument that was used against suffrage, if women could vote, then black women could vote.
Hmm.
Now remember, of course, in the suffrage circumstance, black men were given the right to vote 50 years before women got the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was always that concern of interjecting more
By the 15th
influence.
Amendment, right. Yeah, okay, very interesting. Okay, so there was a racial. I seem to recall also one argument that had a lot of traction back then was the concern that if the Equal Rights Amendment were adopted, were ratified, that there would be no way to restrict the draft to only men. Because the draft was still very much in people's memories, even though it was eventually, we went to the all-volunteer force in the mid-70s. You know, a draft could be reinstituted at any time, and the idea of drafting little Susie in addition to little Tommy upset people enormously.
Yes, and that was based on a lot of stereotypes. I mean, there are a lot of women, as you witness now, if you look at the military service, that volunteer to go into the service, that aren't necessarily opposed to doing that kind of work. There was an assumption that women would be ineffective in the service because they're too small and weak to carry guns and packs. There was an assumption that sexually they would disrupt the service because we couldn't expect the guys to keep their mind on business if there were women around. So those stereotypes made it make raise some concern about women going into the military. And then, of course, the women who didn't want to be drafted away from their children were terrified at the notion that they might, if they're treated equal, have to share an equal responsibility. The primary proponents of the Equal Rights Amendment never shied away from saying we want equal opportunity, and equal opportunity means equal responsibility. And if that's the price you pay, that's the price you pay. But they were by and large opposed to the draft and very much opposed to war in general. As a matter of fact, both in suffrage days and in the Equal Rights Amendment, one of the concerns was that if women gain too much power, they'll oppose the wars. Women tend to be much more in favor
Imagine that.
of peace of the United Nations and so forth.
Imagine not having people be in favor of wars. What a concept.
Well, that was pretty upsetting to some folks, particularly people who had large economic stakes in the war machine.
Interesting. Now, it seems to me also, and correct me if I'm wrong, that not all of the opponents were men or even young men. Many of the opponents were actually women themselves. And I seem to recall that one of their primary spokeswomen was a woman named Phyllis Schlafly, right?
Schlafly, yes. She
Right?
came up late in the proceedings with the Eagle Forum that
The
she
Eagle
founded
Forum, right.
and the Stop ERA campaign.
Right.
And that's one of the most ironic things I think about the ERA. And one of the wonderful things about politics is the irony in it all the time. But Phyllis Schlafly had seven children, went to law school,
She went to, I didn't know that.
and was a professional who was out on the circuit trying to stop the ERA, arguing that women should stay home and raise their children.
I did see I did not know. I knew she was a wife and mother, and I knew she championed wives and mothers, traditional
Right.
wives and mothers.
Right, but she
I
was
did
not
not
traditional.
I did not know that she herself embodied the sort of career choices that the ERA was designed to.
Well, and the other part of the mind warp is the woman who led the struggle for the Equal Rights Amendment was Ellie Smeal, Eleanor Smeal, who was
Right?
president of the National Organization for Women. She was a housewife. She never worked outside the home except for now and its organization. So it was just sort of interesting if you knew the backstory to watch the arguments.
Right. Well,
But
politics is endlessly fascinating.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski about the Equal Rights Amendment, a topic that long predates the 1970s. For the moment, let's go back even further in time and talk a little bit about James Madison.
Madison's friendship with George Washington suffered during the final months of Washington's presidency, following tense political disagreements between the two men. However, Madison demonstrated his long-standing admiration for the father of his country when he addressed the Virginia General Assembly soon after Washington's death in December 1799. Madison said that death has robbed our country of its most distinguished ornament and the world of one of its greatest benefactors. Later in life, Madison often spoke fondly of Washington, noting that the strength of his character lay in his integrity, his love of justice, his fortitude, the soundness of his judgment, and his remarkable prudence, to which he joined an elevated sense of patriotic duty and a reliance on the enlightened and impartial world as the tribunal by which a lasting sentence on his career would be pronounced. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
When a man sat down beside me in a worried sort of way. He said, brother, we're all in danger. You gotta hear what I have to say. 'Cause you know what's gonna happen if they pass the ERA. There will be women in all of our bathrooms, women using all our stalls. They'll be wasting the paper towels. They'll be hogging the urinals. They'll be pushing the old soap squirters, pushing the hot air dryers too. If they pass the ERA, Lord, I don't know what we're gonna do.
Hey gang, it's time for the constitutional quiz, and Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady, is here from James Madison's Montpelier. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now get out your pen and paper and get ready to play along. Do we have a contestant?
Yes.
What's your name, contestant?
I'm Adam. I'm from Philippi, West Virginia.
Philippi, West Virginia? Where is Philippi?
It's actually the first land battle of the Civil War up near Morgantown, West Virginia.
Really? I didn't even know that. Well, we'll have to look into the Battle of Philippi at some point.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Okay, Adam, are you ready for the quiz?
Yes.
Kelly, give it to him.
All right, Adam. I hope you like getting into the Sixth Amendment and some of the rights that are in part of that.
Sixth Amendment.
All right, here we go. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
No, wait, that's all in A?
That's all in A.
Okay.
Adam, we're going long. That's why you got to have your paper and pen ready.
We're going long. Well, don't worry. We'll go back over them. What's B?
Yeah. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction towards time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's B.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for the same. And D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
Okay, I know we're going to need to hear those one by one. So, Adam, just
would you mind to read the question again also?
Absolutely, okay. Adam, absolutely. In addition to guaranteeing a jury trial, the Sixth Amendment also provides that the accused in all criminal prosecutions shall enjoy the rights of A, to be informed of the nature of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to obtain witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
That's A.
That's a mouthful.
What do you think of A, Adam?
I actually think the answer is A.
Okay, you like that one, huh? Okay, it sounds like a pretty good laundry list of things. I like all those things.
I like all those things.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So here, let's try B. B, to attempt to plea bargain down to a lesser charge, to apply any days spent in jail prior to a conviction toward time served, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
I do not think it is B.
How come?
I don't think plea bargaining is a express constitutional right in the Sixth Amendment.
That sounds very impressive. It's not an express constitutional right. It's not actually in there. Okay. Oh, well, that's
Morgantown,
interesting.
West Virginia friend.
Yes, indeed. Philippi.
Philippi, that's
Philippi.
Right. Close.
Come on, that's where the battle was.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay. Go on. So let's see.
C, to act as his own counsel for the defense or to seek assistance for the same.
Well, the right to counsel is a right under the Constitution, but and I think you have a right to act as your own counsel, but I don't think that's expressly enumerated either.
Okay. What about D?
All right. D, to challenge the impartiality of the judge, jury, or prosecutor, to challenge the law under which he is being tried, and to seek assistance in his defense.
And again, I don't think challenging the impartiality of the judge is expressed in the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution.
It sounds like
I'm gonna stick with A.
Sticking with A.
I think that sounds like some things that are in the Sixth Amendment, hopefully.
Well, this sounds like a theme here, is that we've got this laundry list, and each one of them's fairly lengthy.
Yeah.
And essentially it boils down to whether Adam knows what's in there, or because a lot of these things sound good.
They all sound great.
They sound really good, so the question is whether they're actually in the Sixth Amendment or not. And you're gonna stick with A, are you, Adam?
Yes.
Well, Kelly, what do you say?
Adam, well done.
Well done, Adam. That was really, you nailed it. And that was a very tough question because there were lots of things in there, like plea bargaining, which people do all the time. And, like representing themselves, which they do all the time. And, maybe even our constitutional rights, but they're not specifically mentioned in the Sixth Amendment. And so you got the answer correct, and you get your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
I will wear it always.
Excellent.
Wash it occasionally. It looks better.
I will wash it once a week, whether it needs it or not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Adam. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Let's talk some more with Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski about the Equal Rights Amendment.
So apparently the opponents of this, there has to be one other argument that's out there and that we have to mention here. There already, of course, was an equal rights clause, an equal rights provision in the 14th Amendment.
Equal protection.
Excuse me, I misspoke. I'm the guy that teaches constitutional law. I can't keep it straight. Equal protection clause,
yes,
in the 14th Amendment.
Right.
Which, at least in theory, this applies to all of us, right? No state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws, right? Any person within its jurisdiction. Wasn't the ERA already redundant? I remember hearing that argument as well.
Well, that's one of the arguments they made, that the suffragists made, ironically, for suffrage. As a matter of fact, it was a passage of that language after the Civil War that led Susan B. Anthony and others to go and vote, because they said they were citizens and persons. So the 14th Amendment guaranteed them all the rights and privileges of citizens and persons. Of course, she was arrested for that, charged with voting illegally and fined and so forth.
So maybe the Equal Protection Clause didn't apply to women.
Absolutely did not apply to women, was never intended to apply to women. The term citizens and persons used in the Constitution, the Supreme Court tells us, was not with women in contemplation. Hmm. So, because they didn't mean to include women, those terms were.
And if you talk about Equal Protection Clause law, the interpretation of it, it was not until, correct me if I'm wrong, it was 1976 when the court did apply the Equal Protection Clause, at least to a limited extent, to protecting gender discrimination.
Right.
It was 1976, right?
I believe that was the right.
Okay. It was right in that era.
Right.
And in fact,
mid-70s.
I wonder to what extent did the court adopt its jurisprudence in response to what was then called the Women's Liberation Movement.
Right.
And did that adoption take the wind out of the sails of the proponents of the ERA now that the Equal Protection Clause was going to be applied to gender discrimination?
I think it made it more difficult. Anytime you have to explain more, you're losing ground when you're in a soundbite world.
Right.
And so the fact that the court did not say that women are protected to the same extent that we protect other protected classes, race, age, ethnicity, national origin, and so forth, women are judged by a different standard. Most simply put, it's easier for women to be discriminated against and have it be upheld by the courts than it is for the same restriction to be applied to people because of national origin or religion or some other protected class. They don't get the strict scrutiny test.
Right. Well, you mentioned the word strict scrutiny. So for all the con law wonks out there and the lawyers, strict scrutiny is the highest level of judicial review of a government action. And that's what's applied to racial discrimination. So if the state goes out and discriminates on the basis of race, the court's going to make it really, really justify itself before it's going to allow it, and it very rarely does. But they don't apply that same high level of scrutiny. In fact, they apply something called intermediate scrutiny to women, typically gender discrimination. The theory, I think, being that there are some times when it's appropriate to discriminate on the basis of gender or biology. That's the theory. I see you smiling at me, but I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm simply saying that that's what we mean when we talk about the Equal Protection Clause not quite protecting women the same way it protects racial minorities, because of those differing levels of scrutiny that the court's going to use.
Which means that equal protection isn't equal.
You put it much better than I did. Equal protection isn't equal. The lower level of scrutiny applying to women is the justification or the explanation for that. Okay, so in the midst of all of this, the Supreme Court comes out and gives at least limited protection to women, gender discrimination, under the Equal Protection Clause. That probably has the effect of complicating things, making matters more difficult for the proponents, and it happens right when things are stalling for you all. Now, I'm just curious, what was your particular involvement in this? Now, were you already a lawyer at this time when you had your daughter? Okay, this was pre-lawyer stuff for you.
No, I didn't start into law school until I got pretty much convinced that it was going to fail.
Oh, okay.
Which was really a very sad point in my life. No, I was very actively involved in, basically it was a grassroots movement. There was no wealth behind the movement at all. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that in the early 70s when we were trying to get people to vote and to send letters to their congressmen and so forth, women didn't own businesses by and large, which meant they didn't have access to telephones by large numbers. It was a really big deal for us to do telephone banking, where we would talk some business into letting us use their lines at night to call people to get them to write letters to their congresspeople about. We didn't have email.
So
I mean,
you,
I know
if,
that's hard for people.
It's
to
hard
imagine.
For people to listen. This is pre-internet, folks, pre-internet.
Right.
But it's kind of interesting. If you wanted a phone bank,
right,
which sounds anachronistic these days, because,
right,
of course, all of it's done by robots now.
Right. Now, these
if you wanted a phone bank, you had to go find somebody who had a bunch of phones, and so
right,
you'd call up your local insurance agent and say, can we come over and use your phones between 6 and 9 on Tuesday night?
And no way an insurance company would agree to that.
Oh, probably
not. They were
not
very much opposed to the, yeah, Equal Rights Amendment. But we would occasionally find a place with four or five phones, and mm-hmm, we could set up a bank, and we'd go for hours trading off, making the calls. As a matter of fact, I remember we did a number of them from the Women's Center. We developed a Women's Center and had four or five phones. And we would call and ask people not only to write the letter, but to drop off the 25 cents they would spend for postage with the letter, so that we could collect enough money to buy a plane ticket to go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for the Equal Rights Amendment.
Wow.
And I actually traveled on those 25 cent, you know, at a time, plane tickets to,
right,
Washington, D.C. to speak with our senator and our congressman about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Wow. So
it was very much bake sales. I mean, it was
it was a bake sale amendment. Okay, so you were at this time a young housewife with,
yes,
a young child.
Two
young children by this time, who was simply getting involved in this. And so you did bake sales, you did the phone banks, you went to Washington, D.C. What sort of reaction did you get from your Tennessee politicians?
Well, I remember very well Senator Baker, going
Howard
in
Baker
to meet with him,
mm-hmm,
yes. And he was, of course, gracious, a little nervous, perhaps. I came in with a salesman's sample bag full of letters. I had like 1,500 letters to buy my ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in to see him, and he told me that the mail was running 2-1 against the Equal Rights Amendment.
Hmm.
And so I asked him how many total letters he had, and it wasn't very many. It was like 500. And I said, well, now it's 3-1 for it. And I handed him the 1,500.
Well, that was a very effective rhetorical device.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, he actually supported the amendment initially.
Oh, he did?
He bailed on the time extension, which was what I was lobbying for at that particular time. And I think he had other things going on in his life at that point. I later went to work for his law firm, and we discussed his vote many times.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever explain it to you?
Well, no, but I thought I knew why it was. What was sad was he told me he didn't remember voting against the time extension, and that's something I will never forget. So
that he didn't remember voting against
it. I know. That's sadder than if he'd argued with me about it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's tough.
But by and large, they were courteous, but not... I'm sure I was not a very good lobbyist. And I didn't have a $200 suit like everyone said I should have then to lobby in. I had, you know, my Sunday go to meeting clothes. That was about it. So I doubt they were very afraid of us.
Did you ever have anybody tell you that you should be at home cooking dinner for your husband rather than out there doing this sort of thing?
Oh, Lord, yes. Almost every day somebody
mm-hmm
had to tell us that. And that probably fueled the fire for a lot of women because they didn't want to be limited to that role. Not that we didn't want to have families, but we wanted to have careers and opportunities too.
It's funny you should say that, because my own wife, who's also a law professor, has always told me that in her mind, feminism has always been about choices.
Right.
And she certainly doesn't fault any women who want to be traditional wives and mothers. In fact, she spent some time doing that herself.
Right.
But she said it's always been about choices for her.
Right. There was a lot of, I would say, fairly successful propagandizing anti-ERA to suggest that the Equal Rights Amendment was supported by only women who wanted to be upper class women and get big educations and never wanted to be with their children, and trying to drive a wedge between the groups. And it was successful to some extent, though I must say the groups I worked with had old and young and professional and non and about everybody you could imagine in the groups.
Well, I think I heard a different theory about this. It was the father of a friend of mine, and I won't get any more specific than that, even though he's now passed away. But he very once told me bluntly that these women's lib people were simply ugly women who couldn't get dates, and they were unhappy. that's why they were making so much trouble.
That's what they said about the suffragists, too. Right. As it came closer to the passage of the amendment, whether it was suffrage or equal rights amendment, they became prettier. And if you look at the political cartoons, you'll see that. Uh-huh. There's a progression from really ugly ragtag to beautiful women supporting the cause. So.
I see. I hadn't realized there was an artistic progression as well.
Oh, there was. We've left out one of the most important arguments that was the most effective for Phyllis Schlafly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that if the Equal Rights Amendment passed, we would have unisex public toilets.
Unisex public toilets.
That was a huge,
because the government
argument.
Could not discriminate against me from going into a women's room or you from going into a men's room.
That
is
was
it?
That was the argument that they made.
Well, okay.
And it really scared people. I mean, it scared a lot of women to think that men might be coming into their restrooms and vice versa. Not many people stop to think about the fact that almost every home in America has a unisex toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Every airplane you ride has a unisex toilet. I mean, mm-hmm. Even if that were the outcome, it's really not all that scary because of the way it could be handled. But
it
that
could
was
be, and that
those...
was not even, and not even necessarily the outcome.
No,
I mean, because
no.
There are no absolutes under the constitutional
Absolutely.
Law, and every amendment, every part of the Constitution has to be interpreted, and judges aren't stupid.
Right.
I mean, occasionally everybody disagrees with a judicial decision,
right.
And occasionally people will say that's dumb, but you don't necessarily have to imagine the most extreme outcome as
right.
being the most likely outcome.
Well, but it was a ridiculously effective argument that sidetracked people from the real issues of
mm-hmm.
why shouldn't women be paid equally for equal work? Why
well, let's get to that.
Have...
We've talked a lot about opposition arguments, but was that the primary thing driving this? Was opportunities and careers you've mentioned? It was also equal pay for equal work? Was that the other part of it?
Well, that's certainly a part of opportunities and careers, because
mm-hmm.
if you don't have the finances, your opportunities are limited. I think it was also wanting to be full participants in government, having the opportunity in the political world, as well as the financial world, the work world, and even in their homes. I mean, women wanted to feel that they were part of a partnership and not that they were some sort of indentured servants in the home with assigned roles where they had to perform and that only. They wanted to be a part of the society and felt very excluded from the society by customs and norms and politics and careers. Women at that term were earning like 49 cents on the dollar when they performed the same job as a man.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get paid but less than half as much. Now we're up to 75 to 77 cents to a dollar. That's some improvement. But if you think about a career of 40 years and what that means in terms of retirement, contributions and savings and so forth, makes a huge difference. It's no surprise that women are vastly more in poverty than men are.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski about the Equal Rights Amendment.
The next step is to get them to pay me like a fella.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, they're putting me on regular next week, but they're paying me less than they paid the man who used to run the forklift.
Oh, well, come on, Irene. After all, it's a well-known fact. Men are weight more than women.
Archie, have you been reading? reading Playboy?
No, Irene, the Bible.
Bible?
The Bible. And in the Bible it says, God made man his own image. He made women after, from a rib. Cheaper cut.
As a man, and if he was getting paid $6 an hour, why should I get $5.50?
Because, Irene, you're getting what? You're getting $5.50 an hour?
Archie, that's exactly what they're paying you.
What they're paying me.
There goes your rib theory.
And there goes the whole country, meathead. When you see the day that they're giving women the same pay as men and giving women the same jobs, where the hell is it all going to end? And while you're thinking about it, think about this. Equality is unfair. That's right. What's the point of a man working hard all his life, trying to get someplace, if all he's going to do is wind up equal?
After the break, we'll hear what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll talk some more to Wanda Sobieski. Stick around. Well, Kelly, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, we are kicking off our weekend seminar series for...
It's finally here!
It's finally here!
Okay, we've talked about it before on the show, and I hope you've gotten lots of sign-ups from teachers in the meantime, but it's finally going to happen, so give us the details.
October 19th, Friday, October 19th through Sunday the 21st, we will be doing our first weekend seminar of the school year called the Bill of Rights and Historical Perspective.
Okay, now remind me again, who is this for?
This is primarily for educators, but our seminar is open to teachers as well as the general public. There's no tuition for our teachers, thanks to a lot of generous grants and foundations who've supported our programs that we do here, but their general public is welcome to apply to these seminars. Room and board is included, so long as you paid the tuition.
So you get to come and stay in the Constitutional Village at Montpelier. You get to walk over to Lewis Hall and sit in the very classroom where we're sitting right now and talk about the Constitution, and specifically this coming weekend, the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights.
That is just tremendous. And how do people do this?
If you go to our website, learn.montpelier.org, you can apply directly to this program, and we actually have a course which you were heavily involved with on the Bill of Rights online.
Oh, of course, so this will go right along with that online Bill of Rights
course. It'll really marry our online learning experience on the Bill of Rights to our on-site experience of diving into that content of the Bill of Rights.
learn.montpelier.org, and it's coming up, folks. If you haven't signed up yet, get online right now. Stop right now. Whatever you're doing, go to your computer.
Do it right now.
learn.montpelier.org. If you're in your car, stop, find a hotspot, and register, because you need to come.
And there's another one if for whatever reason this one is filled. We've got other programs, or your seminar, your weekend's already, your dance card's already filled. We've got other seminars coming up this school year.
All righty. So we'll look out for those. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Man, I want to go to one of those seminars. But right now, I want to talk some more to Wanda Sobieski about the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, many of us have heard stories about what things were like before the women's liberation movement. And one of the ones that is most poignant for me was one I heard in my own family.
My late mother-in-law would tell the story of one of the first jobs she had as a young woman. I was at a jewelry store, and she was shocked one day to realize that the other sales clerk, a man, was making twice as much as she was. And when she asked her boss about it, his response was, well, he has a family.
Right. That was the excuse very often.
Very often was the case, wasn't it?
And you know what? If he has a family, so does his wife.
That's sort of self-evident now, but I guess the expectation was that young women would work only until they got married, and in fact, if they didn't quit, they would sometimes be fired And certainly they'd be fired if they became visibly pregnant.
Exactly.
Okay, that was, I mean, that was, you simply didn't see pregnant women out in society as much as you do these days.
Correct.
In fact, didn't people used to call it their period of confinement?
Confinement and shame, yes.
Shame, yeah, original sin, I suppose.
Right.
At any rate, that sort of thing happened, and I also recall vividly an old television show that's probably available on YouTube now called All in the Family.
Yes.
Which was very much dealing with these sorts of issues, and it had the very traditional marriage of Archie Bunker and his wife, Edith.
Mm-hmm.
And he was portrayed as having a lot of the attitudes that you're mentioning about husbands. And I think that that's very instructive, the sorts of traditional roles they had and how resistant at least the husband was to change.
Right, right. And Edith, in the role that she played, was always sort of poking at that, trying mm-hmm. to, in her own lovable way, get around the problems that that resulted from being in a limited position. I mean, back to the arguments against the Equal Rights Amendment, one of the things that people argued was that if the Equal Rights Amendment passed, the states would have to nullify their protective legislation. And their, quote, protective legislation often was like what I ran into when I worked in Missouri at that time, was women could work no more than 40 hours during a week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's not really very helpful, because what that means is those women can't go into management where they're on call 7 days a week or 6 days a week. And so women got, I wouldn't call it a glass ceiling, I'd say a concrete ceiling with a lot of this protective legislation, because you could only work in those categories. And then to add insult to injuries, those laws would typically exempt the fields that women traditionally were in. So this didn't apply to housekeepers, and this didn't apply to the maids in the offices.
Or the
there.
Nurses.
Or the nurses. It only applied to, you know, those kind of jobs where you might get into management and make some real money.
So they really didn't seem all that protective.
No, and I personally ran into that.
Oh, really? Tell me.
Oh, I drove an ice cream truck to put myself through college. Okay. For a little ice cream company.
Mm-hmm.
And the company...
I wish I had had that job in college. That never even occurred to me. All right, but go on.
Okay, it had its drawbacks. But in any case, to drive the ice cream truck really required 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week to keep the route up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the company that I work for that I won't name... they got around that by making the drivers independent contractors. We leased the trucks, and then we bought the ice cream and the ice, and we resold it, did it that way. But if I wanted to go from being a driver to a supervisor, who was clearly a company employee, then I would work maybe 4 hours a day, work the load out in the morning, but I would have to be there 7 days a week. Well, I couldn't work more than 5 days, 40 hours, 5 days. That was protective legislation. So I couldn't become a supervisor. I could work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, but I couldn't work 4 7 days a week and get that additional money that I would get, which was quite a lot more. So
that is remarkable. And this was in
1971.
So a young man could work as many hours as he wanted to, but a young woman could not because of your delicate constitution,
I suppose. That's it. Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
And
wow.
So we were kept out of the easier jobs that paid more. But if we were in the really drudge jobs that women were pretty much assigned to at that point in time, then the legislation didn't apply. So it didn't help the people that really needed the help. It just kept us out of advancement and certainly out of management. I'm happy to say that company found a way around it, but it involved keeping our personnel files in the trunks of their car, so Fair Labor Standards people came by, they wouldn't find us, then we had to pretend to be drivers.
All right, then. Well, we certainly won't mention the company's
That's
name,
right.
then. I understand that. Well, it's remarkable. When I tell my students, and most of them are young people in their early to mid-20s, about this, they don't realize the extent to which gender roles were really seemingly set in concrete at that time. In fact, hearkening back to that TV show I mentioned, All in the Family, there was a riddle once posed on that show, and I won't do it justice, I won't repeat it, but basically the riddle was a very, very difficult one, because in order to answer the riddle accurately, you had to realize that both women and men could be surgeons.
Right.
Okay, that was basically it.
Right.
I mean, it's just, and I remember being utterly flummoxed by this riddle. I mean, how could it be that this, you know, surgeon is the child's parent if, you know, it's not dad?
Right.
It was, the answer to the riddle was that it was the child's mother who was the surgeon. But our gender role thinking was so set that, you know, you thought surgeon, you thought man. That was it.
Well, and most people didn't think an engineer could have a baby. That was one of the songs that Peggy Seeger made.
Oh, really?
Famous during that time, going to be an engineer, about a little girl who wanted to grow up to be an engineer, and everyone told her she just needed to be a lady. Mm. And there was a lot of that kind of pressure. And when I was in college, I took chemistry as a minor because I thought it was interesting, and I wanted to take something interesting. I couldn't take it as a major because they wouldn't let me.
They wouldn't let you? Where was this?
It was in Kansas.
In Kansas. And they wouldn't let you major in chemistry.
Don't need women in that field. Women can't do it. Too much math, you know, too much science. It's not a field for women.
We don't want you to worry your pretty little head.
There you go.
Oh, good heavens. Okay. So, well, see, again, this is almost unfathomable to modern young women, but I think it's very important for everyone to remember this sort of thing.
Well, I think it is. And I, you know, I was vastly disappointed when the Equal Rights Amendment failed.
Well, let's finish that up. We've gotten to the point where you said that Tennessee, you didn't make a lot of traction with it. So I'm guessing Tennessee was not one of the ratifying states.
No, Tennessee ratified.
It did ratify. Okay, well, now
you're teaching me more. And then rescinded.
Oh, gee, tell me more. What happened?
Well, it ratified fairly early, and then in 1974, Tennessee decided to rescind the ratification. And
now, that's not mentioned in Article 5 either.
No, that's
rescission,
one of those other
of ratifications.
Right. That's one of those legal questions that remains unanswered, whether any of the rescissions of the ratification actually count.
So
I say 35 states ratified, that's correct.
Right.
But 4 rescinded.
So 39 at one point or another had ratified.
No.
Oh, excuse me.
No, 35 total ratified, 4 of those rescinded.
I
so
see.
Is the count 31 or is it 35 for purposes of reaching our number, magic
now
number
I see.
Of 38?
Okay.
And
so when you all would win in a state, that didn't
right.
end the battle.
No.
The opposition would continue and try to convince the legislature to take it back.
Absolutely.
Had that ever been done before? And I don't recall that having been done in constitutional history off the top of my head.
There had been, if I recall, at least one amendment that had some rescissions associated with
uh-huh.
it, but they were never given any legal effect. And they didn't matter, frankly. They didn't change the
mm-hmm.
actual outcome. But with the Equal Rights Amendment, 4 of them, 4 states rescinded. It was... No, I take that back. 5 states rescinded.
5 did, okay.
It was Idaho mm-hmm. in 1977, Kentucky in 1978, and an interesting thing there is that the woman governor of Kentucky vetoed the rescission. So where does Kentucky stand? Ratified? Rescinded or vetoed the rescission?
Oh, of course,
the Constitution doesn't give the governors any power to... veto either.
But she did it anyway.
But she did. So.
Oh my goodness.
So
okay.
There's that question. And then Nebraska adopted the amendment but had a technical flaw in the original resolution and so went back and again under another resolution numbered ratified. But when they rescinded the original ratification that was probably ineffective anyway and not the intermediate one. So I'm not sure how you count Nebraska.
Right.
That's why I'm a little confused about how many rescissions. Then Tennessee rescinded in 1974, and South Dakota then did a rescission in 1979, but they said in the process, because it was right about the original time extension ran out and the mm-hmm. 3-year extension was granted to 1982, they said that no ratifications after March 22nd, 1979, which was the original deadline, would be effective in any state. not just in South Dakota.
So South Dakota legislated on behalf of the whole nation.
Yes, they did. Apparently they tried to. Okay. So that was basically what they had. So then we had a district court decision in Idaho that upheld the rights of states to rescind, mm-hmm. And struck down the time extension. That went to the Supreme Court, but by the time it reached the Supreme Court, it was 1982, and the time extension had expired, so everything was moot, so nothing was decided on rescission or time extension.
Oh, man, so this whole issue of rescission was headed for the U.S. Supreme Court, and they could have opined on it, but they said, it's moot.
That's right.
And now, that's disappointing, because that's an interesting and important question.
Well, it is, and the time extension is too.
Yeah, time extension is extremely important as well. You know, initially whether Congress can even limit it.
Right.
But secondarily, you know, can it be extended? Well, you know, my goodness.
I guess if they could limit it, they could extend it. Was the theory that the pros went with.
And if you can ratify, you can rescind, I suppose. But of course, you can't rescind after ultimate ratification. I mean, you know, if Tennessee ratifies and enough other states ratify and it becomes part of the Constitution, it's not like Tennessee can come back a year later and say, never mind, you know, and take it back and thereby amend the Constitution through a rescission. I mean, you can't rescind indefinitely, but the question really is, can you rescind prior to the ultimate ratification of the amendment? I don't know that there's necessarily an answer to that either.
There actually have been some states that have rescinded post-ratification, but nobody's paid any attention to them.
Doesn't make any difference.
Right. Matters not. But the real question is, you know, so what's the legal status? So some people would say, we just need three more. Look at the Madison Amendment, 203 years. We're going to ignore this whole time limit stuff, and mm-hmm. we're going to go ahead and get our...
So there are still people today who are proponents of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Absolutely.
Who want three more states and who say, we've got 35, we're going to keep our 35, and we don't care about that 7-year limit or the 10-year limit.
Right. There are a lot of people waiting for the right opportunity to move forward with this. It is an extremely important part of our history, and it embarrasses me that as much as we talk about justice and equality, that we really don't mean it because we're afraid to put it in writing in the Constitution.
Well, if there are any people who want to join you in this effort, now where can they reach you?
Well, I'm on the web at SobieskiMesser.com.
Spell that for people, because I think they'll have trouble with the Sobieski part.
Okay, it's SobieSki.
Okay, SobieskiMesser.com.
Yeah, Messer, MESSER.com. Yeah. Right. And that's where we can usually be reached. But if you look at what happened in the RA campaign, the arguments against, the arguments for, it's really not much different than it was for suffrage. And it's the same sort of fear tactics. We were called socialists. The suffragists were called socialists. I mean, there's a real strong link in all the efforts to discredit the progress.
What's that old expression you shared with me, something about polite women not making progress? What was it?
Well-behaved women rarely make history.
Well-behaved women rarely make history. Well, I guess you're anything but well-behaved then.
Apparently.
Well, thank you very much, Wanda.
Okay.
And that's our show. I'd like to thank very much Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski for sharing with us her fascinating personal experience and her intimate knowledge of the Equal Rights Amendment, a recent but all too often overlooked incident in our constitutional history. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Thanks, Carol. And our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn all about it.
I don't want no
Next time on your weekly constitutional, ERA, ERA, we want what? The ERA? Do you know what it was? Do you know what it is? Well, I'll give you a hint. It had something to do with equal rights and with amending the Constitution, and it all happened just a couple of decades ago. Next time on your weekly constitutional, ERA, ERA. Do you know what the ERA is or was? Here's a hint. It had something to do with equal rights and with amending the Constitution. We'll talk all about it at 3 o'clock Sunday and at 8 o'clock Tuesday here on WETS-FM and HD1.